From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the American obsession with pills, with drugs. The science writer Thomas Hager has a new book that tells the backstories of 10 of these drugs. He says the thing that has driven the development of drugs over the years is the search for a magic bullet, an all-powerful medicine that comes with no risk. Well, there's no such thing. The book is called 10 Drugs. We'll be right back. Hi, podcast listeners. So you probably know we also make short films, and so I just wanted to get you to watch our latest. It's about a U.S. Army soldier, Alyssa Peterson. She conducted interrogations during the most intense moments of the fighting in Iraq, and in 2003, she died by suicide. The film is the story of her brother, Mitch, who wanted to learn what he could about her death. He told us he owed it to her. The film is called Casualties. Go see it at radiowest.org. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Coming up in a moment, our conversation with the science writer Thomas Hager. He has an interesting new book where he explores our history with drugs. And to tell it, he's chosen 10. 10 drugs that have shaped our attitudes and history of medicine. But first, we need to tell you that Radio West is taking a break. We're going away as a show for a bit. It's not a long break, a few months. We're taking the summer off, basically, because we need to take some time and think about how we're doing. We've been doing Radio West for 18 years now, and I hope you think the show works most of the time, but it's always good just to stop what you're doing for a minute and look back, see if you're still producing the thing you had in mind in the first place. It's a summer vacation is all. Think of it that way. And we'll be back in the fall, and I don't think the show will have changed all that much, but it will have changed some, in the good way. Our last show will be this Friday, and we have something in mind to fill the slot. You'll be hearing about that soon. And you may have other questions, and if you do, send us an email at radiowest@kuer.org. We'll miss you guys, and we hope you'll miss us too. Okay, on with the show. Thomas Hager's new book is not a screed about Big Pharma and the American obsession and dependence on prescription pills, but he is plenty skeptical about the role profit plays in the development of drugs. There's this thing he says in his book, and he keeps coming back to it, that no drug is good, no drug is bad, every drug is both. In other words, Hager says drugs have done amazing things for human health and our lifespans, but they've also given people unrealistic expectations, and they've reshaped the way we practice medicine. The book explains how we got here. It's a series of what he calls mini-biographies of 10 drugs he's selected. They're not necessarily the greatest hits, but they are historically important, and they all have great stories attached to them. The book is called 10 Drugs. Thomas Hager teaches journalism and communication at the University of Oregon. He joined us from a studio in Eugene. Let's begin with a number that you write about of pills, not the 10 drugs that you focus on, but how many pills does an average American take on a regular basis?
I came up with a number that just astounded me. It was 50,000 pills over a lifetime for an average American. And I figured this number based on an exhibit that I saw in the British Museum in London, where an artist and a doctor had gotten together, created an exhibit of all of the pills taken by an average British person during their lifetime. And it was 14,000 pills. And I couldn't believe it. Those pills covered a table that was more than 40 feet long. And I thought, well, if that's true in Britain, what is the case in the United States? And I ran some numbers. And I came up with a significantly higher number for the U.S. here in America, we are the world's number one drug takers. And I figured we take, on average, about 50,000 pills per person over our lifetimes. Mm.
Now, this gets at what you explore in the book, and that is, what are we to make of that number? Is that it's excessive, that we're dependent on big pharma, that we're dependent on easy fixes, or that it's about medical progress? I guess it's a bit of all of that.
It's a bit of all of that, and even more, I think. So often in today's society, we live in a time in which we're surrounded by technology. We're surrounded by all of the wonders that science and technology have brought us. And sometimes we don't really think much about it. It's like we're breathing it in all day and we just exist. We live our lives and we're thinking about our families. We're thinking about our careers and our money. We're not thinking about the technology that surrounds us. I thought about drugs as a kind of technology that is woven so deeply into our lives. We don't think much about it. But it's really fascinating to know how that happened, how we got to where we are.
No drug is good. No drug is bad. Every drug is both. That's what you write. Explain that, because that's an important thing.
Yeah. To me, that's the central lesson of the book. We tend to demonize drugs to a great degree because we have such severe problems right now, especially with opiate and opioid drugs and addiction and overdose. And new drugs come along that are addictive, that have a downside, as all drugs do. But we'll focus on some and demonize them. Or else, on the other hand, sometimes new drug, wonder drug, will come along and we will laud it to the skies. It's like the best thing ever. It's the wonder drug that's going to solve all of our problems. That happens every so often as well. So we tend to have this split personality when it comes to drugs. They're either horrible or they're the best things ever.
Yeah.
The fact is that, as I wrote, every drug is good. It has a positive effect. And every drug is bad. It has negative side effects. You don't get any drug without both those things. They have effects that are both good and bad. And I think it's good for us to think about them in that way. Take a more balanced view.
You say up front in the book, and this kind of goes back to what you were saying earlier about the number of pills compared to the Brits, for example, that are being used in America. Americans consume more pharmaceuticals than any other country. And why is that, do you think? Why is it that we're different? This seems interesting to me.
It's a combination of things. I think that, in my research for the book, I looked at a lot of factors that distinguish Americans from other people around the world. One very important factor is that we're rich. We have a higher average income than most people in the world. So we have more money to spend on our health. We have more money to spend on things that make us feel better, like drugs. Mm-hmm. So we simply have the money for it. That's part of the reason we're such a huge market. You know, here in the United States, we spend $34 billion a year on over-the-counter drugs, the kind that you get at your local drugstore. And we spend $270 billion, almost $300 billion a year on pharmaceuticals that we get by prescription. That's a huge amount of money. Mm. Part of that's based in just the health of our economy and the fact that we're blessed to have high average incomes. That's one factor. Another important factor, I think, is that the kind of medicine that is practiced in America is really dependent on and based to a large degree around drugs now. Mm-hmm. And that is a process that's been a long time in the making. It's rooted back in the days of patent medicines, mm-hmm. 150 years ago in the U.S., in which people were encouraged to try these nostrums to cure anything. Well, we got used to the idea that we could cure a lot of stuff with drugs. Now, with modern pharmaceutical companies and their marketing divisions and their sales abilities pushing their newest drugs on the public and onto the medical profession. Well, now we're in the situation where physicians are very, very comfortable prescribing drugs and people are very comfortable taking those pills. That's just where we are. So it's a comfort level thing. It's a money thing. It's a societal thing. I think it has to do with our freedom-loving natures as Americans. Mm-hmm. We like to do what we like to do. If we want to take a drug to solve a problem, to cure an ill, well, we'll take it because mm-hmm. we're accustomed to medicating ourselves from the first days of our republic until now.
Well, we'll get back to this idea of how our attitudes have changed about drugs, because that's an interesting part of the book. We should define, though, the scope of this book. You're not including illegal drugs. You're focused on the legal ones and mostly the prescription pills.
Yes.
So explain a little bit about what you wanted to do with the 10 pills. This is not, we should say, the most famous pills or the most groundbreaking pills. You talk about how you chose the 10 or 10-ish,
yep.
as you say.
10-ish drugs. The book is called 10 Drugs, and as the name implies, it focuses on 10 really sort of families of drugs. But there are 20,000 different drugs available to us now. Tens of thousands of drugs, new ones coming up every day, practically. So there's a huge universe to choose from. What I tried to do was choose 10 that showed not only how drugs evolved over time. In other words, I'm telling the story of the evolution of drugs from prehistory until now. And I wanted to find drugs that represented certain stages in that history. That was an important factor. So they're important drugs, but a lot of them aren't well known. I also chose them because of their entertainment value, because I love telling stories about science. I think that a lot of people get turned off to science because it's hard. It's got a lot of math and formulas and stuff. And what I try and do is tell stories about science that open it up to people in ways that's very comfortable. And I do that through telling stories. So each drug, I thought, had a fascinating story. Each drug said something important about how drugs have evolved and how we've gotten to where we are with drugs. And it was a combination of importance and entertainment.
Mm. Well, let's talk a little bit about the history of drugs. And the word itself, you mentioned, comes from a term for keeping herbs. How did that end up being the name we now know and use as drugs? Because it seems like far disconnected from nature in some ways today.
It is today, but it didn't start out that way.
Yeah.
You know, in the beginning, people have been taking drugs as long as there have been people on Earth. In the old days, there was no industry around it. You know, 10,000 years ago, in prehistoric, before people started writing history down, humans were already harvesting medicinal plants and using them to cure ailments. Herbal medicine has been practiced as long as people have been around, as far as we know. In the book, I spend a lot of time talking about opium and the joy plant, as it was called by the ancient Sumerians, and tracking its progress to today's, you know, super synthetic opioids like fentanyl that are killing so many people now. That process, very interesting. But that just shows you, because we found traces of humans using opium way back, before the Greeks, before the Romans, before the Egyptians. As long as there's been people around, we have been using opium to ease pain because it's a wonderful pain drug. So all of this started from people picking plants and finding that they had what was thought to be magical qualities for healing. So it was an herbalist's art in the beginning. As trade picked up around the world, and people started shipping things and caravanning things back and forth, drugs were part of the cargo. They were packed in barrels, often, or in satchels, kept dry. And the name for the barrel, actually, it was an old, I think it was Dutch term, for the barrels that carried drugs and kept them dry, that carried these leaves and herbs. The name of that barrel became our word drug.
Hmm. Let's get back to the joy plant. This is morphine, of course. That's the name of the chapter. Talk a little bit about you talk about the early days of it, how this magical juice comes from this poppy and not just any poppy, and you go through all of this. Explain a bit how it comes to be developed, because it comes to be kind of the perfect tool for early physicians and early healers.
Yes, and there's never been a drug as important as opium in the history of all drugs. It is the mother of all drugs, I think, because opium was so powerful that people were very, very interested in it. And What scientists try and do often when they find a natural substance like opium is opium comes from the sap of a poppy seed pod.
Yeah.
And it's still gathered that way all around the world. They grow the poppies, they grow the seed pods, and they cut them with a knife and they weep out this liquid that is raw opium. Scientists wanted to know, well, what is it inside of that sap? Mm-hmm. There's a whole bunch of stuff in the sap. What part of it is the heart of the opium's power? So they tried to take the sap apart and find the chemical constituents within it. This process in which you take a natural substance, which is often a rough mixture of stuff, it contains a lot of different materials, and what you want to do is get to the essence of it. You want to get to the heart of that natural substance to find out where its real power comes from. That art of finding the spirit, the soul of a substance, was called alchemy. And a lot of people are familiar with that term now. Alchemy is very important in the history of science. And alchemists got a hold of opium, and they tried to find what gave opium its power. They were unsuccessful for many years until finally a chemist in the very early 1800s came up with a way to pull the opium sap apart and isolate the one molecule in it that was really the painkiller, the main painkiller inside opium. And he found it, and he found that it helped people sleep and it helped people deal with their pain. Morphium was his original name for it, after the god Morpheus, mm-hmm. the god of sleep. And morphium became today's morphine. It was the most powerful constituent of opium, not the only one. Codeine also is in opium, and thebaine, a lot of other powerful drugs. But morphine was the most powerful. That was isolated and purified, and it became tremendously popular, especially in the United States around the time of the Civil War. Yeah. And I tell the story in the book about doctors who now had purified morphine, and thousands, tens of thousands of soldiers coming back from Civil War battles with their legs blown off and their arms blown off, these terrible wounds, horrible pain, chronic pain. They treated them with morphine on the battlefield, and then they treated them with morphine after they got home, and they kept treating them with morphine because by then, tens of thousands of soldiers were addicted to morphine. They called it the army disease, or some people called it the soldier's disease. It was all of these addicted veterans who came back to American cities in the 1860s, late 1860s, 1870s, addicted to morphine. They kept shooting it, and morphine spread through society from there, became an enormous problem. It was really the first opioid epidemic, and that was 150 yeah. years ago.
Gosh, that's so – well, you do point out the differences between – that time and this time. But it seems like in some ways not all that much has changed in our inability to be able to treat this addiction. It seems like we're still grappling with that.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, it is true. The one thing about writing history, which I enjoy learning about, is the ways in which history doesn't – well, Mark Twain wrote, you know, history doesn't necessarily repeat itself, but it often rhymes. and it's true. When you look at the history of – especially with these opium derivatives like morphine, we are faced with a problem and, you know, we develop a wonderful new drug. Morphine is a terrific painkiller, still mm-hmm. very commonly used, still highly addictive. We get all excited about it. We shoot it into people. Then we find out it has the negative side. It has the addictive problem, the overuse problem. That happened with morphine. And so we came up with a solution for that. You know, morphinism, as they called it, the disease of being addicted to morphine, morphinism was such a big problem that scientists all over the world decided they needed a new drug to cure it. Yeah. They needed a new drug to get people off of morphine. And so I tell the story of the scientists in Germany who in the 1890s came up with this wonderful new way to get people off of morphine. And it was another chemical treatment of an opium derivative. But this one they thought was non-addictive or far less addictive than morphine. Anyway, they put it on the market. This was the Bayer company in Germany. They put this wonder drug on the market. They were so keen on it that it did such wonderful stuff. They named it after the German word for heroic because it made people who took it feel heroic. And the word in German for heroic is heroisch. So they called their new drug heroin. And they put it on the market. They sold it. They put it in cough medicines. They put it in soothing syrups for babies. Cough drops had it. It became a huge bestseller for a very short period of time. And you used to be able to buy heroin, this new wonder drug, through mail order. You could order it from a Sears Roebuck catalog, and they would send you back this nice little carrying case with a couple of syringes and a couple of vials of heroin. That was, you know, what life was like around 1900. So we went through this process of, you know, wonder drug, crisis with the wonder drug, new scientific answer for the crisis. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, people find out that the new wonder drug, heroin in this case, was worse than the one it was trying to replace. It was more addictive, not less addictive. But it started, you know, what became a heroin epidemic. That was the next wave.
Yep.
And now we're looking for, of course, new wonder drugs that will stop the heroin epidemic and all of the other opiates, OxyContin, fentanyl, and so on, yeah. Opioids. So, you know, we keep playing the same song over and over.
Before we leave this section of the book, this part about morphine and heroin, I wanted to go back because you write about in the early days how the poppy came to be associated with marking the passage from life to death. In other words, right from the start, I guess, there's this realization people could die from this. And I guess that's another one of those sort of give and take ebb and flows of this particular drug is that the power of it, the danger of it.
Yes. And as you noted, you know, if you go back in history, back to the earliest Greek writers in ancient Greece, or even before that, physicians knew that drugs that came from the poppy plant, these opium-based drugs, they understood that they were wonderful painkillers, of course, but they also understood that they could easily kill the patient if they were given in quantities that were too high. And they knew that they made patients addicted, that they were dependent on the drug. And they knew that the drug, when it was given too often to the same person over time, made them less active, more somnolent, more put them into a dreamy state, as opiates do. That has been known for thousands of years, and yet the power of the drug is so great. You know, its healing properties, its beneficial side. And we have to remember that opiates and opioids are the best painkillers humans have ever found. They're the best pain drugs around and always have been. That benefit is balanced with this bad side of addiction and overdose. But it's the same balance that has been there since the very beginning. We're just facing it in new forms with new names,
yeah.
But it's the same basic dance.
Thomas Hager, his book is 10 Drugs, How Plants, Powders, and Pills Have Shaped the History of Medicine. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER.
KUER is listener-supported public radio. And our most dependable support comes from our nearly 9,000 sustainers, people just like you who make ongoing monthly contributions. Starting at just $5 a month, you can become a sustainer too. Go to KUER.org, click on the donate button, and tell us how you'd like to contribute. Use your credit card or make it even easier with a direct withdrawal from your bank account. Join our growing community of sustainers today at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking with the science writer Thomas Hager about the American obsession with pills, with drugs. Hager has a new book that tells the backstories of 10 of these drugs. It's called 10 Drugs, How Plants, Powders, and Pills Have Shaped the History of Medicine. Let's talk about the drugs that have been fueled by our sex drive. And I guess we should start with the pill, contraception. This is another one of those stories that is about hits and misses. Why don't you pick up the story from when sex hormones first come to be understood? This gets us to this Austrian physiologist. He's an interesting man. You call him a man before his time.
Yes, yeah, indeed. In the story of the development of the contraceptive pill, in addition to its importance for our society, contraceptive pills, most women, I think, are keenly aware of the fact that these pills changed a woman's place in society because they allowed a woman to decide when she wanted to get pregnant. That was something that was pretty new, and it opened the door to a lot of social changes, a lot of career changes, and opportunities for women. It really changed our society. You can't overestimate the importance of the pill. But its development took a very long time because we had to understand, before we could develop the pill, scientists had to understand how the birth process was controlled within the body. And that's a very complicated process. So a lot of work had to be done outside of the drug just to understand the hormonal system and the endocrine system in humans, and how that works to control fertilization of eggs. That was many, many years in process before people found that indeed, ovulation was controlled by a small number of hormones. And if we could somehow find something that would control those hormone flows in the body, then we could prevent ovulation. We could have contraception. But it took years of study in order to find ways that we could tweak that system gently enough so that it wasn't dangerous and yet powerfully enough to have a reliable contraceptive pill. And I tell that story in the book. It involves a drug development guy who had to go down to Mexico and try and smuggle plants out of Mexico that had the starting material for these drugs, and Margaret Sanger and Kathleen McCormick, these very important women's rights activists who funded this research.
But this is where you get to this idea of how the development of a drug is often influenced by the culture and the social changes of a time. This is a good example of that.
Yes, very much so. It was necessary not only that we understand the hormonal system in the human body, all this science stuff. It was also important to have the push that came from women's rights activists who knew that this was an important process for women's rights. So it was the activist side that funded the science side that led to the pill, and it changed our world.
Well, so you write about how women wanted, they were looking for freedom and choice. Men, they wanted control over, as you put it, unruly human impulses, which gets us to kind of one of the entertaining, I have to say, parts of the book, efforts to deal with erectile dysfunction. Let's start with the man named Giles Brindley. And I'll just read this from your book. Here you are. Giles was a composer of music, and in addition, he had a strong interest in erections. And not only that, he did a lot of self-experimenting with his penis. Talk a little bit about Brindley. He's a really great character in the story.
Brindley is one of my favorite characters in the story, and he's not important in a scientific sense, but he is important to show what life was like before we developed drugs for erectile dysfunction.
Yeah.
Back in the old days, the late 70s, early 1980s, erectile dysfunction is a serious problem for a lot of men. And I have to recognize the fact that, in thousands of cases, erectile dysfunction is a life-changing debility
for some
men who have serious cases of it. And so a lot of physicians were looking for answers, and they came up with these like mechanical devices that, these splints and balloons, and everybody was trying to find an answer. Giles Brindley was this oddball researcher who thought that he had a shot, that he developed this chemical shot that had to be delivered directly to the penis and had all kinds of drawbacks. But he thought it was terrific, and he developed this by experimenting on himself. And so he wanted to announce his discovery to the world. And so he's at this urology conference. I think it was Las Vegas.
Yeah, Las Vegas.
He's at this urology conference, an audience of other urologists, people who are interested in erectile dysfunction.
Men and women, we should say.
Yes, it was a mixed audience. It was a mixed audience. Yep. Nobody knew exactly what was going to happen in this presentation.
Yeah.
Giles Brindley comes up to the podium, and he's wearing a tracksuit. He's, you know, one of these old tracksuits, like a velour kind of tracksuit.
Yeah.
And which is odd in and of itself.
Right.
He starts talking about his new discovery, and then he announces that he's going to display the results. And he pulls up the bottom of his tracksuit. He said, you know, before I came out for this talk, I injected myself with some of my new drug that I've got. And he pulled up his pants, you know, he tightened the crotch of his pants so that the audience could see the results.
Yeah.
And people were craning around to get a look. And he said something along the lines of, well, this doesn't display it well enough. And In this scientific meeting, he dropped his pants, and he started to walk out toward the audience. Women were the audience members were yelling, and there was a general alarm in the hall. When he finally, I think, woke up to the fact that this was not the usual presentation style for a scientific presentation. So he pulled his pants back up and went back. But that was kind of where life was back in the, you know, around 1980 when it came to erectile dysfunction. Giles Brindley's thing went away. He became a laughingstock, and his discovery was not really useful. But it did highlight the fact that there was a market for drugs or treatments that could solve erectile dysfunction. And a lot of laboratories started looking for it. Then again, in one of these accidents that happens over and over, there's a laboratory in Great Britain, a drug research laboratory for a pharma company in Britain. And they were looking for a cure for angina. Mm-hmm. You know, angina is that pain you get when you have heart problems, mm-hmm. the pain that goes down your arm. And they were looking for an angina cure, which has to do with blood flow. So they were testing drugs to solve blood flow problems. And they weren't coming up with anything. They were testing. And they came up with one drug that they thought might be good. They tested it on humans. And they found out that it had side effects. It gave people headaches, and it wasn't a very good drug for angina. But there was one side effect they hadn't expected.
Mm-hmm.
And that was that the men who were given this drug reported that it didn't do much for their angina, but it did give them like a days long erections, and their sex lives had improved as a result. And the people in Great Britain looked at that side effect. This was something they weren't expecting, and a bell rang in somebody's head, and they said, "Well, this may not be good for angina, but maybe we can keep working with it, and we can make it something that will have other purposes." So they kept working with that drug, and they refined it into what today we call Viagra.
Yeah, and you mentioned this gets us to a big part of the book, and it's one of the threads that runs through it, of course, is that the drug industry, of course, big pharma. And so this brings us to Pfizer and how the timing for this particular accidental discovery couldn't have been better for Pfizer. Let's talk a little bit about the way these drugs then develop, because there are some lessons that we learned from this story about Viagra. And I guess one of the things before we get to some of those lessons, talk about what is known as the siege cycle, because it refers to the way a drug comes out with this huge promise and enthusiasm, and then at some point there's a switch where people think it's terrible, and then it switches to this more balanced kind of reaction. That's kind of you were sort of talking about this earlier, that's kind of ebb and flow and give and take in terms of the attitude. But before we get to the actual lessons of what we learned from Viagra, talk a little bit about that cycle that seems to be seems to happen mm-hmm. in the development of a drug.
Yeah, that's a good point. One thing you see happening over and over and over again with drugs is this initial enthusiasm, wild enthusiasm, often fueled by drug company advertising and marketing, which is, you know, drug companies are masterful at marketing their products. They're very, very brilliant corporations in that respect. They know how to sell drugs. So, you know, you get this burst of enthusiasm and it looks like this new drug, you know, X, whatever the new drug is the greatest thing ever for the condition that it's supposed to cure. And everybody gets excited about it. The drug company's excited. The physicians get excited. The public gets excited. There's been nothing better. There's this enormous honeymoon period for the new drug. And that's stage one of what is now a named process. Stage one is this honeymoon period. Stage two happens when the side effects of the drug, which is now popular, the side effects start cropping up. And people start reporting and hearing about the terrible things this drug can do. And every drug has side effects, so there's often bad ones. Mm-hmm. That's stage two of the process. And then in stage three, everybody takes steps back. The drug's been around for a while. The sales have peaked. We know the negative side effects now. And so we can have a balanced view in which we know the good and the bad of the drug. Mm-hmm. And we're learning more about it because more studies are being done. And then it takes its place in the regular pantheon of drugs. And it achieves this balance point. That's stage three.
Yeah.
So stage one is wild enthusiasm. Stage two is horrible realization that it's really terrible.
Right.
And stage three is this balanced view that all drugs eventually get to. There's this German researcher named this three-step process. It's the Seiga cycle now. Wild enthusiasm, terrible realization of how bad it is, and then this balanced view. Every drug goes through the Seiga cycle.
Same thing happens with Viagra, of course, the Seiga cycle. It blasts off, then eventually fades. But you mentioned that the rise and fall of Viagra comes with these lessons, and I wanted to talk to you about them. One of them, one of these lessons is, as you put it in the book, drug companies need big blockbusters to survive. Talk about that.
Yeah. You know, we've moved from the book tells the story not only of drugs, but also of drug companies. You know, the drugs, the companies that are such huge corporate players now in the world, whose business it is to discover and market and sell drugs. People call it big pharma, you know, the pharmaceutical industry, big pharma. And it's often demonized. You know, people think that they're money grubbing or, you know, there are a lot of critics of big pharma, and there are a lot of proponents of big pharma who think it's necessary for our world to find new drugs, and only large pharmaceutical companies can afford to do that discovery process now. And they're very big proponents of big pharma. I come down somewhere in the middle myself. I try and be as even-handed as I can be. In the book, I'm not a critic of big pharma. I think they're very important. But neither do I think they're the best people in the world because they have their problems too. What it points out to me and I'll go into Viagra as an example of this. But what it points out to me is the importance of money in this process.
Yeah.
It's not just about health. You know, drugs are about money, big money. The pharmaceutical industry worldwide is a $1 trillion business every year, turns over $1 trillion. It is such a rich industry that wealth tends to make its own priorities. And the priority for drug companies is to make money. That's their corporations, and they are built and designed to make money. When you get money into the picture with drugs, what you end up with is today's system. Today's system is based around finding big selling drugs to bring in enough money to fund all of the research that is necessary to find more drugs. And research is expensive. It may not be as expensive as drug companies say it is, but it's tremendously expensive. So you're right. Drug companies need blockbuster drugs. They need huge sellers to keep the whole show rolling. They need to bring in large amounts of money. The way you do that nowadays is not by finding a new drug like, say, a new penicillin. You know, we need new antibiotics, but there's hardly any money going into antibiotic research right now.
Yeah.
And the reason is because when you get sick with a bacterial disease and you take an antibiotic, you take it for two or three weeks, a month, and solved, problem solved.
Yep.
The, you know, your disease is cured and you stop taking the antibiotic. That's great for the patient, but it's not good for the drug company.
Right.
Drug company stops making money on that antibiotic when you stop taking it. What drug companies have figured out is that the real money is in drugs you take for your whole life. You want drugs that don't necessarily cure a disease so that you don't need the drug anymore. What you want are drugs that maintain a level of health or a feeling of wellness that are necessary to take for many, many, many years. Then your market is permanent. And until a patient dies, you keep making money. So the profit motive has, I think, skewed drug development toward drugs that don't really cure things so much as make life more livable for people.
Yeah.
New example of a drug like that is statins. And statins are among the world's biggest selling drugs. They're used to prevent heart problems. And they can be very effective in a small group of patients as well. But statins are now being recommended for basically everybody over 65.
Yeah.
And when you get to an audience like that, when you get to a potential market like that, that's where the big money is. The other thing about statins is they are taken for pretty much your whole life. The bottom line for the drug company is once you get started on a statin, they're pretty cheap and they're pretty effective and they have relatively low side effects and you just keep taking them because you want your cholesterol to be low because if your cholesterol is higher, you think your risk of heart disease is higher. So they, what they do is develop and market drugs now that are designed more for milder conditions that are lifelong. And so we're going to see a lot more of that because the world is aging. We're all getting older. The world is graying. And the older you get, the more minor problems you have, sometimes serious problems, but the more interest you have in being healthier longer, you tend to take more drugs that will be lifelong commitment. And that's part of the reason we're taking those 50,000 pills,
mm-hmm.
is because we keep larding on more and more drugs like statins that will, you know, have a small chance of preventing what could be a serious disease. And we're interested in that. So, you know, we'll keep moving in that direction. So there's this whole economic scientific juggernaut that is moving toward more and more drugs for more and more people over a longer and longer period of time. So I imagine that, you know, over the next 10, 20 years, that 50,000 pill number that we talked about at the beginning is going to just keep going up.
One of the things you write about early in the book is that you've become convinced good old-fashioned progress plays an important role in the story, that when the system works well, then it's really can be progressive. And what you seems to be saying is if we can manage the balance between all of this, we can create some really great things. But you also say it's only a fool would try and predict what the future of drugs is going to look like. We're still in that process of what? Only really guessing about where we are headed, I suppose.
Well, you know, it is foolish to, I think, especially in the scientific world, it's foolish to try and predict things because so often those accidents happen and whatever you predicted goes out the window at that point. But along with that, there is this progressive scientific portion that you mentioned that is real. And it's especially important for this reason. We now have tools in scientific laboratories that allow us to track very small amounts of molecules in the body in great precision, greater and greater precision all the time. You can find out what drugs do more effectively at the molecular level. Mm-hmm. It's not just the old system. You know, with opium, early prehistoric humans, somebody tried that sap from that poppy and found that it had a terrific pain-killing properties. And nowadays, what we do is we look at the molecular structure of the enzyme we're trying to affect in the body. We understand the body in greater and greater detail, and we're able to design drugs for specific things. And that is a tremendous shift in how we find drugs now. It is beginning to yield some wonderful new drugs. I talk about monoclonal antibodies as an example of a really terrific class of drugs, I think, that has come about in just the past 20 years, 30 years in a big way, and is changing medicine. Those are the kind of wonder drugs that will continue to show up. And I use the wonder drug, the term wonder drug. I use that advisedly. I don't believe that many drugs are really wonder drugs. Yeah. Monoclonal antibodies may be the one exception to that rule. We'll find out over the long haul. We're in stage one of the Saiga cycle with monoclonal antibodies.
Yeah.
Right. But we'll see. So, yeah, the thing is that as they find out more and more about these molecular level interactions and how drugs work at finer and finer levels of resolution, we are able to see not only what existing drugs do in the body, but we use the drugs as a probe to examine how things work in the body. So drugs become a tool in themselves, not just to cure disease, but also to explore the human body. And because we can track them so effectively, we can find out more about how the body works. Well, that is a wonderful process, because then we understand more about the body so we can develop better drugs. And as we develop better drugs, we can use them as tools to understand more about the body. And that is the most hopeful thing in drug development right now. We are learning so much more about how our bodies work at a finer and finer level. And drugs are an important part of that.
You write in the book that there's some reason to believe the research and development model that we've been so accustomed to all of these years might be going a little flat. And so you raise this question, does it mean the industry is primed for a major disruption? What are you expecting on that front?
Yeah. You know, every drug company, every big pharmaceutical company is facing some of the same challenges. One challenge is that, as I mentioned, we're learning more and more about the body. The body is a fascinating and extraordinarily complicated, you know, biological device. It's a biological organism at the level of a human being is extraordinarily, wonderfully complicated. And there is so much that goes on within your body to keep you healthy. We're finding out places that drugs can affect those processes to bring about better health results. But despite all of that complexity and that wonderful variety in the body, it is limited. We are not infinite. We are, in a set of processes that occurs that has an end to it. So there are only so many targets for drugs to work on. There are only so many places that a drug can positively affect outcomes. Mm. And we're beginning to nudge toward that point of finding out what the last of those targets are. Many of the early targets, like, you know, the weak points in bacteria that were found with antibiotics, or the ways that the mind works with all the mind drugs that we have, tranquilizers and antidepressants and so forth, they are all first steps in this process of finding out how our bodies work at sort of an ultimate level. When you're talking about chemicals, you know, you're talking about chemical reactions in the body, there is a limit to the number of chemical reactions that happen. That's a limit on where drugs can work.
Well, it made me wonder about whether or not the disruption that may be coming isn't with drugs, but people coming to a more a deeper sense of how their own body works and not taking drugs at all. Is that possible? That could be one of the disruptions, is people just stop taking 50,000 pills a year.
It's very, very possible. And that's a hopeful thought. And I believe that there's validity to that idea. Certainly, as a result of my research in this book, I am a much more careful consumer of drugs now. I have a much better idea about why they're being marketed to me and how they're being marketed and sold to me. So I'm an educated consumer now. What I hope is that more and more consumers get educated about the whole industry, about its pluses and minuses, and then they're able to make better decisions about what they do with their own health.
Yeah. You say you came to the book with this kind of, like when you originally started researching it and writing it, you had a sort of dispassionate look about everything. You know, a drug isn't good or bad, it's both. Let's see what we find. But you say after having written the book that you found you did have some kind of an agenda. Here's how you put it in the book itself. You said you realized your agenda may be this: rescue the development of drugs from the control of for-profit corporations, which is a pretty ambitious undertaking. Talk a little bit about where you ended up after writing this book.
Yeah. You know, and you're absolutely right. The genesis of the book was to be as even-handed as possible. But as I went through more and more stories about the development of modern drugs in particular, I found that for-profit large pharmaceutical companies were perfectly capable and had a history often of skewing data, of presenting things in as rosy a hue as possible in order to sell their product. And that is their job as a corporation. They're brilliant at it. And I give them all the credit in the world for being as good at their business as they are. Those guys are really good at selling drugs. But the downside of it is that, you know, because it's for profit, they tend to try and develop the kinds of drugs that we talked about that are lifetime drugs for relatively small problems, but that tend to keep their profits rolling in long term. That, I think, is not about human health so much as it is about making money. And that's just the reality of the drug world right now. People are there to make money for their corporations. And so you get this skewing, this sort of distortion of what's really important and for humans and what's really necessary for health. And that is where I ended up in that quote, is just the point that, you know, maybe there's a way where we could do drug research and development that was oriented strictly at doing good for human beings, you know, at real health problems for real people, doing the most good for the most people possible. And that's a tough one, you know, because it sounds easy to say. It's very idealistic to sort of say that should be our goal. In reality, very difficult to do, because drug companies know that it costs enormous amounts of money to do that kind of research, and they're willing to plow their profits back, a portion of their profits, back into that research. If we want to do something else as a society, if we want to take it in a more public-oriented way and away from that profit motive, we're going to have to find ways to pump enormous sums of money into drug development. We haven't shown that resolve, I think, as a society. Very few societies have, and those that have not made as much progress as drug companies do. So the private corporation has its downside. It's got its plus side too. They're very aggressive at finding new drugs. And so it's a tough one. There are no easy answers.
Thomas Hager teaches journalism and communication at the University of Oregon. His new book is 10 Drugs, How Plants, Powders, and Pills Have Shaped the History of Medicine. He joined us from a studio in Eugene, Oregon. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.